This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a gallery exhibit examining environmental pollution, a musical parody of an iconic film, or a chamber music concert of rarely heard gems, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. Environmental pollution across our nation is a hot-button issue. Now two exhibits, LaToya Ruby Frazier, Flint Is Family, and The American Dream Denied, the New Orleans residents of Gordon Plaza seek relocation, on view at the Newcomb Art Museum of Tulane, take the issue head-on. Joining me are museum curator Laura Blairow and communications director Miriam Taylor. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Diane.
Thanks.
These exhibits deliver a 1-2 punch on man-made environmental disasters and the impact on families as a result. Why did you hone in on environmental pollution?
This is Laura. Environmental pollution here in Louisiana is definitely one of the most critical issues affecting all residents. And this body of work by LaToya Ruby Frazier also hadn't yet been exhibited here.
Yeah, this is Miriam. In the response exhibition, which was organized by students at Tulane, The American Dream Denied was a great opportunity to address issues that are happening locally as well, because environmental pollution isn't just a one-off. It happens everywhere and affects everybody.
Let's begin with LaToya Ruby Frazier's exhibit, Flint Is Family. How does she explore the water crisis with lead exposure in the exhibit?
She is an artist, activist, MacArthur Genius Awardee, and she spent 6 months in Flint photographing these beautiful portraits of families.
In about 25 works, she is basically carrying the narrative of a family, the Cobb family. Shay is the central figure. She's a mother, and she's also a daughter, so we meet other folks in her family. And as she cares through, you know, just the basics of everyday life with her family, meals and things, we see the presence of the water bottles. There are really wonderful extended captions that are written by LaToya Ruby Frazier that explain things such as how mealtimes impacted and when the family goes to restaurants, they're drinking bottled water and such. Water is such a vital part of all of our lives. So for that type of crisis to occur really shakes all types of routines and things in a family's life. So we get to see how the family's routines are interrupted. But then also there are moments of joy, too, that are captured, such as a cousin's wedding as well that takes place in a courthouse that we see images of in the exhibit. So there's really this context of how that family unit is what made them all get through this difficult moment.
Now, it's been 5 years since this man-made disaster imposed environmental and health concerns for the residents of Flint, Michigan. Where do we stand today? Can residents drink tap water without fear for their health?
They are still dealing with this. As recently as this past summer, there have been updates from the mayor. They are saying that she is not confident in the decisions that have been made, saying that it's safe to drink. And there are changes that are happening with the legal battle that affected the community, but it's definitely still something that they're dealing with.
And this all came about because of a change in the source of the city's water supply.
Absolutely.
A little closer to home, you explore the lived experiences of residents affected by pollution in the exhibit, The American Dream Denied. The New Orleans residents of Gordon Plaza seek relocation. This began as a story, I believe, of the American dream for African American families seeking home ownership. What happened?
This is a really long story. It's fascinating. It's tragic. It's still ongoing and unfolding in front of us right now. Essentially, the EPA declared the site on which these residents are living a Superfund site in 1994. Remediation was done until 2002. And through the research of the Critical Visualization and Media Lab at Tulane, led by Dr. Christopher Oliver, many residents have actually offered interviews to explain what their struggles have been since then and actually getting off that land and figuring out how to build a new life.
Where is Gordon Plaza?
Gordon Plaza is located in the Upper Ninth Ward, very close to the Industrial Canal. Some people might be familiar with Press Park and the Desire neighborhood. These are areas that are adjacent to Gordon Plaza.
It was in the late 1970s that the city utilized funding from the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development to build the residential neighborhood, but they did not tell the residents at the time that they were living on the site of a former landfill.
And a toxic landfill at that, because when it was developed, the language for hazardous waste didn't exist in the EPA.
Wow. And this is a landfill that serviced the city.
It serviced the city for 50 years. Starting, I think, in 1909. Mm-hmm. And then it was closed in the 1950s. And then after Hurricane Betsy came in 65, it was used, you know, intermittently for waste at that time. things containing heavy metals and all kinds of chemicals that are, of course, dangerous to human health are buried in the soil. And in the exhibition, people interviewed who lived there recounted digging in their soil and finding glass and all kinds of bottles and things with the skull and crossbone sign on it. It's really quite impactful. The visuals of this exhibition, as well as those stories, they're just so compelling. The residents have an incredible spirit and message to carry forward.
And it's part art show. So we have these gorgeous pieces from Hannah Chalu, from Livana
Varnado,
to Sean Baitanti. There's a lot of different artists who are addressing the stories of the residents in their own works. And then there are photographs and videos and audio from the residents themselves.
And there are residents who continue to live in this area that are trying to find a way to be relocated?
Yes, there are about 50 families, as I understand it, a little bit over 50 families. We have incredible footage and also maps that explain what the site looks like, because many of the buildings in this area have been demolished due to the environmental concerns. Some of the public housing in that area has been already taken down, but those who bought their own homes and invested hundreds of thousands of dollars still remain.
Wow. You're putting the two exhibits together that tell a pretty powerful story of environmental pollution, but you're also having family-friendly activities around these two exhibits.
We are. First, on Thursday, September 5th, we have our opening reception, which also will include a panel with environmental scientists, activists, and residents talking about the impact of environmental pollution. On Friday at 1 o'clock, we're going to have Wilma Subra, who is a chemist, give an exhibition tour. And then Saturday is our family day. We will be having exhibition-themed activities, talking about recycling and environmental issues with children and collage making, how do you tell your own story. We'll have young audiences of Louisiana there putting together an activity. It's open to all ages. We are always free and open to the public.
What do you hope will sit well with viewers after this experience?
I hope this exhibition will bring attention to the Gordon Plaza residents and create more awareness in New Orleans of the history of toxic waste here and how it's been treated and the proximity of it to residents. I think it'll create more awareness, you know, in terms of health and wellness, just overall in general, because that's really what unifies the Flint exhibition along with the local exhibition.
Exhibit curator Laura Blero and Newcomb Art Museum communications director Miriam Taylor. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having us, Diane.
Thanks.
Once again, Newcomb Art Museum's opening reception for the exhibits Flint is Family and the American Dream Denied takes place on Thursday, September 5th from 5 to 8 p.m. on the Tulane University campus. More info on additional activities are online at newcombartmuseum.tulane.edu. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. The Big Easy award-winning Storyville Collective with Dr. Mister Productions presents the regional premiere of Silence, the musical. Silence is the unauthorized parody of the Academy Award-winning film, The Silence of the Lambs. Artistic director Michael McKelvey joins us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much.
You're changing hats on us, artistic director with Summer Lyric Theater, and now the Storyville Collective?
Yeah. Summer Lyric is an ongoing project, but most of our producing takes place in the summer. So during the off months, probably August through May, I have to keep busy artistically. So a few years ago, we started the Storyville Collective to kind of bring pieces that gain popularity off Broadway or lesser known Broadway shows and bring them to the Big Easy.
So this has been a few years in the making.
Yeah, 4 years.
4 years, wow. Now, the mention of the film The Silence of the Lambs brings back images of a psycho-horror thriller with the infamous cannibalistic serial killer and psychiatrist Dr. Hannibal Lecter. But this unauthorized parody is anything but a horror thriller. It's hilarious.
It is hilarious. Basically, they stay very true to the original storyline in the film. Our heroine, Clarice Starling, is right at the center of everything in her encounters with Hannibal Lecter as she searches out the serial killer Buffalo Bill. Jack Crawford, her FBI mentor, is part of this and all those characters. But in this one, we have a chorus of singing lambs that act as kind of the Greek chorus for the show. And almost any famous quote from the show is either done through the script in this production or they sing about it.
So now let's back up a little bit and do the storyline in the film and bring us up to speed.
So there is a young FBI student or officer in training, Clarice Starling, and she is put into action by her mentor, Bill Crawford, to seek out the serial killer named Buffalo Bill. To get inside the head of this serial killer, they send her to meet with a cannibalistic serial killer who is in solitary confinement named Hannibal Lecter. And so she has several interviews with Hannibal Lecter where he helps her to unravel the puzzle of who is Buffalo Bill and how to get to him.
And the title, The Silence of the Lambs, what does it refer to?
So it actually refers to an incident that Clarice had when she was growing up. After her father died, she was sent to live with her uncle. And it describes this screaming of lambs as they were being slaughtered. And those sounds of the lambs still haunt her to this day. So in one moment in the show, Hannibal says to her, "Are the lambs still screaming? Can you hear the lambs still screaming?" So that's something that's woven within the framework of this story, her troubled childhood and how she's trying to overcome that.
What will we experience in the musical?
When we get to probably our most dramatic moment, we will then break into song. And there is a song called Quid Pro Quo, which is another quote from the film, where it turns into a tango number between Clarice and Hannibal Lecter. We have a Buffalo Bill singing a song called Are You About a Size 14? Because that's what he says to one of his victims, Catherine Martin. It's when he abducts Catherine, but it turns into a country hoedown number.
Now, the musical is filled with songs and with language that might make a sailor blush.
Yes. Yes. It's difficult because I've done interviews for the show before, and I really can't say all the titles for the show because there's profanity usually found within them. But
within the title.
Yeah. So there's a bit of profanity in the show. The show is not scary. It is hysterical. But for fans of Silence of the Lambs, they seem to really love the show. They relish because it pays homage to the show. It doesn't poke fun at it. But it really does. I'm a fan of the movie. I think it's one of the finest films ever made. And I take great glee every time I listen to the soundtrack because it's not a spoof of it. It's a parody. We're just simply having fun with some very serious subject matter. So,
yeah, I wondered how you crossed that hurdle.
We try to treat it respectfully, but the fact that we do break into song, that's funny in itself. The fact that we do have a Greek chorus made of lambs, that's funny. We really tried to keep the scripted scenes straight. I asked those actors, just deliver this as you would deliver any real drama. But in a second, it's going to get very, very funny and uncomfortable because we're going to sing and we're going to dance. And some of you might be wearing lamb ears. So...
Tell us more about the cast. Who is playing Hannibal Lecter?
Well, Hannibal Lecter is the wonderful Kevin Murphy. He's one of the smartest actors I know in town, gifted singer. He's eating this role up with relish, so to speak. That's a bad pun there. Hannah Rakall is playing our Clarice Starling. We have a flashback sequence where we meet Clarice's father, who was shot in action, who's a police officer. That is played by Matt Reed, who plays Papa Starling. Ardelia Mapp, who plays Clarice's best friend in the show, who barely says any lines in the movie, is being played by Rebecca Gordon Kirk. Finally, Elise McDaniel is playing Catherine Martin and her mother, Senator Ruth Martin. Also, we have Dr. Chilton, played by Derek Toops. He's the psychologist assigned to Hannibal Lecter, and a myriad of other actors. There's 11 performers in the whole show.
And what will be the big takeaway for audiences?
I think they're going to discover this gem of a show that most of them don't know exists. It's not widely released for production. We feel very fortunate that we've been given the rights to do it.
Storyville Collective Artistic Director Michael McKelvey. Thanks.
Really appreciate it, Diane.
Silence, the musical, will play at the Twilight Room at the Always Lounge, 2240 St. Claude Avenue, September 6th through 16th, and at the New Orleans Arts Center, 3330 St. Claude Avenue, September 19th through 28th. More info at brownpapertickets.com. The period of art Deco. That influenced building and design comes alive musically as Musica Chamber Ensemble explores the architecture of music in a series of concerts kicking off its 14th season. Musica violist and president Bruce Owen joins us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Diane.
Congrats on 14 years and still going strong. How's the new season looking?
Oh, I'm really excited about it. You know, we had this whole idea about having the analogy to architecture, to the structure of music, because, you know, architecture is known for its style, its design, and its beauty, as is music. But of course, architecture has a sort of permanence that music doesn't necessarily have, because you see a building and it's there. And a piece of music, of course, has its permanence when it's a piece that people hear a lot. But of course, one of our goals in our group is to play music that doesn't get played a lot, either because it's new or because it's by composers people know about, but they don't necessarily know about these particular works.
So take us on your journey. What will we hear and experience?
One thing we're excited about is we're playing a piece by Sergei Prokofiev. He wrote a sonata for two violins. This was a funny quote. He heard a performance of an unsuccessful piece, he didn't say who it was by, for two violins without piano accompaniment. And he said that it struck him that in spite of the apparent limitations of such a duet, one could make it interesting enough to listen to for 10 or 15 minutes. So this sonata for two violins is not a long piece. It's four movements. It's not more than, I think, 15 minutes. Then we're going to play a piece by Eugene Ysaÿe, who's a Belgian composer, and he wrote originally a duet for two violins. He wrote it for his pupil, who was the Queen Elizabeth of Belgium. He was a Belgian composer, but it was really hard. So they added a viola part to take some of the notes. So this piece is actually a trio for two violins and viola. It's funny because I was doing some research and actually found a string quartet arrangement. Somebody said, this piece is still really too hard. Let's add a cello to it. But we're doing his version for two violins and viola. We're also playing a piece by an English composer named Eugene Goossens. He was an English conductor and composer, and he wrote a piece called Suite for Flute, Violin, and Harp. He wrote this in 1917. I thought there was an interesting connection between him and Ysaÿe because Goossens happened to be music director of the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra from 1931 to 1946. Ysaÿe was actually an earlier conductor of the Cincinnati Symphony from 1918 to 1922. So it's kind of funny how these composers overlapped in other respects, that they lived in the same city. We're also playing a piece by Joaquin Turina, his piano quartet in A minor. This was written in 1931. One thing that's interesting about this piece is that it's cyclic. Themes that come at the beginning, you hear again in the third movement. It's such beautiful music. Of course you want to hear it again. It's probably about 18 minutes, but it's a really wonderful work. We're really excited about it.
And you're also featuring a work by a living composer.
Yes, we thought, since it is the autumn, I know it doesn't feel like it right now, but
we're getting there.
And actually, it won't be technically be autumn, but we want to bring it in. So we're doing a piece by a composer named Juliet Robbins Moore. She is a harpist who has written a lot of really great music, and we're doing a piece that's called Fallen Leaf, and this will be for harp and English horn.
It sounds like a beautiful program.
Well, thank you, yeah.
How did you go about choosing the composers?
I was looking at the Turina. That was a piece that I have never played before. And I started looking at what other composers who lived in different parts of the world during that time were writing. And that sort of made the connection. And so I just started trying to find out what music sounded like from different parts of the world in this very similar time in history. A lot of people can be scared off by 20th century music. They think that it's going to be really dissonant or harsh. A lot of composers reacted to World War I in a way that made them write music that was very dissonant and difficult to listen to, not very accessible. But these pieces sort of go against that. These pieces, I feel like, find a beauty and elegance that is very similar to the kind of architecture that was really prevalent during that time from the late teens up through the early 1940s.
How does the music complement the architecture that you envision?
The iconic example is the Chrysler Building in New York that has, you know, a series of arches that get smaller and smaller as they go up to the spire. And a lot of music's like that, where it has a theme that repeats over and over, but maybe in smaller fragments, and then it goes up in range and goes off into the sky.
You've just painted a beautiful picture.
Well, thank you.
And how do you round out your 14th season?
So the other two programs that we're doing also refer to types of architecture. Our concert that we'll be doing in February, we're calling Keyboard Cornerstones of Bach and Fauré. Johann Sebastian Bach wrote a keyboard piece called the Goldberg Variations, and there's a really great arrangement for string trio, violin, viola, cello that we'll be playing part of. And then Fauré, who, like Bach, was an organist and also played various keyboard instruments, wrote a really great piano quartet, the Piano Quartet in G minor. So we'll be playing that, and then our flute, harp, and oboe players will be doing a few pieces that are also by Baroque and French composers. Then our final concert is the one we're calling Bridges Between Countries. Bridges, of course, a type of architecture that connects people from different parts of the world. And we are premiering on that concert a new piece by our bass player and composer, Dave Anderson. He's writing a septet for violin, viola, bass, harp, flute, bassoon, and percussion.
Wow.
And he said a lot of it's funk-based, so because he's really into that type of music. But he also is very influenced by a lot of composers from different parts of the world. And we thought it would be really interesting to feature some other composers who influenced him, who themselves either lived in the United States or studied with composers who were from America. So we're playing some pieces by Hinnestare and Hindemith, and there will probably be a few surprises on that concert as well.
Well, I can hardly wait to hear it. Musaica violist and president Bruce Owen, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me.
Save the dates. Musaica Chamber Ensemble opens its 14th season with two concerts. The first takes place on Monday, September 16th, in Metairie at Munholland Methodist Church, followed by a performance on Tuesday, September 17th, in New Orleans at St. Charles Avenue Presbyterian Church. That's our show for this week. Major support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Additional support comes from Le Petit Theatre. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette on Tuesdays at 1 p.m., Wednesdays at 8:30 p.m., and a shortened edition on Thursday mornings at 8:45 when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.